today is Thursday, the 4th of February 2021, and the purpose of this recording is twofold. It's all to do with a podcast I'm going to record with Brian Micklethwaite, hopefully early next week, and it's partly as an introduction to the subject for anyone who may happen to listen to this, and it's also for Brian's benefit, so that he can see if I have understood what he is saying. Maybe I should explain this. This is a podcast that we have wanted to do for a very long time. It's on the subject of the Industrial Revolution. But there have been all sorts of... I think we originally were planning to do it well over 6 months ago. Unfortunately, you know, both of us have been ill. I've had to move. There have been various technical problems. I mean, I can't remember exactly. I mean, it's something like we've had to postpone it sort of 4 or 5 times. And we finally got to the situation where we think we can do it. So we're damn well, my attitude is we're damn well going to do it. I'm not sure quite what Brian's attitude is. Anyway, now, I mean, I'm assuming I'm talking to an audience of libertarians. What we tend to think is that, first of all, we think the Industrial Revolution was a good thing. I think that's almost universal amongst libertarians, and I think it ought to be universal amongst everyone. But anyway, universal in the universe, even. And we tend to think it was because in about 1800, Britain was not only the freest country in the world at the time, Americans might disagree, but it was the freest country that had ever been up to that point, and indeed actually probably the freest that has been since. And we say, well, that's why the Industrial Revolution happened. But why did Britain get so free? Up to now, I have been very happy with the sort of the Finlay Donaghy argument. Finlay Donaghy wrote a wonderful piece for the Libertarian Alliance 25 years ago called The Industrial Revolution, How Britain Got Lucky, I think that's the title. And his argument was that Britain just was lucky amongst European countries in that it was a naval power rather than a military power. Navies can't easily oppress their people, whereas armies can. So it was very, very difficult for a British government to oppress its people. Therefore, Britain was free. I was very happy with that argument. I mean, you could also argue that there's a tradition of liberty in Britain. I think a chap called Alan MacFarlane does that. Emmanuel Todd, later, argues that there is a lot of this is to do with family structure. And he has a whole theory about family structure and how that tends to impose itself on a nation, a country's political structure. Anyway, Brian begs to differ. Brian has been doing a lot of reading recently, and it's not just one person. I mean, it's a bit of Emmanuel Todd and his views on literacy. It's a bit of Anton Howes, who's, I think he's a PhD, he's quite young, but he's an economics historian of the Industrial Revolution. And there is Steve Davis, who I think many listeners will know of. He is, I'm actually quite sure, is he editorial director of the IEA, Institute of Economic Affairs, and Deirdre McCloskey, who's an American economic historian. Now, there are several arguments here, but I think the crucial one, I think it's Davis, is that he argues that the Industrial Revolution was a far more ideological enterprise than we tend to think. Now, I'm not quite sure where. I mean, in discussions with Brian, we've talked about the Levellers, who were doing their stuff in the around the time of the First Civil War. That's the English Civil War. And people like Watt, James Watt and who's the other chap, Matthew Bolton, and people like this, the sort of entrepreneurs who I think were active in about 1800. I mean, the first thing that disturbs me slightly about this is the time gap. That's 150 years. And I think Brian's argument, if I've got it right, is that the levellers failed politically, but they succeeded economically. Now, I have argued, said to Brian, well, hang about. You can't succeed economically unless you succeed politically, in a sense. And I think it's more, I think the difference there may be that their political, the ideas of what government should do succeeded, where their ideas of what government, how government should be constituted, democracy essentially, completely failed. So that may be true. And what else was that? I think Brian also has a certain he argument about Todd. Now, Emmanuel Todd is a French anthropologist, and one who Brian takes very seriously. And I think if Brian takes him seriously, I think the rest of us have got to take him seriously. He argues. Now, I've talked about the family structure, but this isn't actually an argument about family structure. It's about literacy. He argues, I think he actually argues, and Brian says he argues, that in the Industrial Revolution is literacy, or perhaps more accurately, literacy applied to, well, doing stuff, your job. And I think Brian's counter-argument, if I understand it, is that there were, at the time, there were much higher levels of literacy in, say, Sweden and Germany than there were in Britain. And yet those two countries lagged far behind. I mean, I think the first question is that true? Were literacy levels greater? I think I'm pretty sure that it's true that literacy rates, the Sweden and Germany did lag behind. I heard tales of Sweden being really quite a poor country up until about 1900. I think the question then is, were literacy rates actually so different? I've heard that literacy rates in Britain were actually quite high, even as early as the Civil War. It'd be interesting to know. Maybe someone could tell us. Anyway, I think that's about it. I think that is my understanding of what we're going to talk about. And hopefully we'll begin, with Brian saying, well, I've got it right or wrong. And maybe we can talk about that. Anyway, I think that's me done for now. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the podcast, if there ever is one.
Well, it's February the 16th, 2021, and we have finally got around to doing the podcast we've been promising for months.
Yes.
On the subject of the Industrial Revolution.
At last, the 1948 show.
Yes. If I'm speaking rather quietly, it's because I need to, because I have a persistent cough, and if I get too enthusiastic or excited, I'm liable to break out into coughing. But my voice is a bit better since I've had some treatment for it, so I'm optimistic that I'll be able to manage. How are we going to do this? Are you going to ask questions or am I going to present my thesis?
Well, I hoped that the recording I recorded 10 days ago.
Oh, yes.
Will be the basis, if you can remember it.
I can remember, the main thing I can remember was the one thing which I thought you got wrong, which was Steve Davis's thesis. I'm jumping ahead of myself. Perhaps I'll make a start by saying that I've got a pile of books in front of me. Three of them are by Deirdre McCloskey. They are The Bourgeois Virtues, Bourgeois Dignity, and Bourgeois Equality. Then comes Stephen Davis's book called The Wealth Explosion. And finally, there are three books by my man, Emmanuel Todd, who I keep going on about. There are two that I've long treasured called The Explanation of Ideology and the Causes of Progress, which date from, I believe, the 1980s. And then there is his most recent book called Lineages of Modernity. And that's my pile of books. And what I think can be said about all these arguments and propositions is that they're like the pieces of a puzzle, and they fit together. And I'm the one doing it. The authors of these books, in some cases, are hardly on speaking terms. I mean, Davies and Deirdre McCloskey, Davies especially. Oh, by the way, there's one other person I want to mention also who's not written a book yet, or not a book on this subject yet so much, and that's Anton Howes. I've done a blog posting on my personal blog with a link to his Substack site, where he has a succession of essays on economic development themes, very well worth reading. And I think that between them, these authors basically explain the Industrial Revolution, even though they're not, as I say, not many of them are not communicating with each other. I mean, McCloskey, Davies, and Howes are probably...
Oh, I thought when you said they're non-speaking terms, they had fallen
well,
out.
They're near, well, Todd, I suspect. Todd, they dismiss, for reasons which I'll get to. But I think we ought to start by saying that you and I both agree that the Industrial Revolution has been a wonderful thing. McCloskey, in particular, spends a lot of her time banging on about what a splendid improvement it has been for mankind, and I take it you thoroughly agree.
Yes.
We're fond of gazing happily at that graph, you know, the one that goes almost horizontally for almost the whole duration, and then at the right-hand end, it suddenly goes almost vertical at about 1780, and you and I both think that this is one of the great history dates of the human species. Without it, there's no way we could be doing what we're doing now, you know, having a conversation along some wires and through the ether, and you're recording it with all kinds of fancy software, and it's all going to be listenable to by people on what amounts to a kind of magic network. None of that sort of thing is imaginable without that kink in the graph.
Pretty unimaginable even to the pioneers of 1800, I'd say.
Yes, I mean, what I'm going to be arguing is that the Industrial Revolution was an ideological event following from McCloskey and Howes, who point this out.
Do they both and, say it simultaneously?
But even the ideologists didn't, I don't think they foresaw quite how much good they would do. I think they hoped for, in their words, an improvement in the affairs of men. In other words, a sort of slow but steady takeoff, perhaps a slight increase in the slope of the graph, but nothing like the kink that actually happened.
Now, who do they identify as the ideologists? Because that did come out in my intro.
Well, McCloskey, to me, the most interesting group she identifies goes back to the 17th century, and that's the Levellers. John Lilburn and that whole time, that there was, that, I mean, it's hard to keep track of all the things I want to say, but it's tempting to dismiss the 17th century ideology of the Levellers and the Puritans and all those people as purely political, and in many ways it was. I mean, their central question was who should govern, and their answer was everybody. You know, the king has no special right to some sort of unique voice in the affairs of state.
To my mind, the Levellers are first Civil War, is that correct?
Yes. They're the 1640s, I think, is Lilburn's time. I think he was executed, I can't even remember when, but around then. He was a stirrer and a pamphleteer. But he also argued for the rights of the common man, not just to participate in politics with an equal voice, but also to participate in the economy in the way that he personally thought was right and was in his own best interests. And that crucially involved the right of inventors to devise new methods of working. and new kinds of gadgets and to sell them to whoever they wanted.
Previously banned, was it?
Well, you've got to understand that a labour-saving gadget in about 1500 is a death sentence to the labour that's saved.
Uh-huh.
And,
right.
You know, I mean, I think one of the most interesting questions you can ask about any period of history is how many people can afford to be unemployed for a month without dying of starvation? Well, in 1500, the answer was practically nobody, except the lucky 1%, you know.
Is this something that McCloskey talks about?
Not so much. I have to admit, I've not read every word of McCloskey's voluminous writings, so my judgments about what she hasn't said are, frankly, unreliable. But I, from what I've read of her books, the impression I get is that she concentrates on what writers and pamphleteers and proselytizers said. She doesn't discuss why people, or so much anyway, why people were influenced by these writings. And this is where Anton Howes comes in. He, to my satisfaction anyway, proves what McCloskey only asserts, which is that it was ideological, this argument about economic life and how it could be improved with inventions and improvement. Improvement is the word they keep using.
It's the ideologists using that word, improvement.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes. But what Howes does is to get inside the heads of inventors. He sort of collects inventors in his work, and he asks himself for evidence of how they were thinking. Why did they become inventors? What were they thinking? What were they trying to accomplish? And he establishes that the invention mentality is like an infectious disease, a benign infection, which spread almost from one person to another, in the form of the claim that being an inventor is a worthy and splendid thing, better than had previously been assumed.
Yes, I suppose when does the actual word come into the language, I wonder?
Or improvement.
Or inventor.
Inventor, I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Interesting.
I mean, this
and
is my
when
first...
would it have been accepted as okay?
Well, I think during the 17th century is when the argument was seriously made. It's not to say there hadn't been innovations and inventions before.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, things like gunpowder and the printing press are pretty big things, and they were
yes.
well before the Civil War. So
yes. Well, I think the printing press in particular, the motivation was often religious. Certainly, some of the earliest writings published by the printers were religious. Anyway, that's what McCloskey and Howes have contributed to the way I understand all this. I have a recollection of asking Anton Howes at a meeting some years ago, what do you think about the rise of mass literacy as a trigger for all this? Because obviously you've got all these ideologists. If people can't read what they've written, well, then they're dead in the water. So you need mass literacy for their writings to start having some impact. He dismissed it. He said, oh, no. And his reasoning was very simple and very interesting. And it was that if mass literacy was the trigger for the industrial improvement that I'm assuming we all agree happened and was a very good thing, if it was the trigger for that, well, then it would have started in Germany and Scandinavia, because that's where mass literacy first arrived.
I suppose the question arises, how do we know that?
Yes, I don't know how, and now I come on to Immanuel Todd. I don't know how Immanuel Todd knows that, but he asserts it with great confidence. And certainly in terms of the results, Germany was convulsed with religious quarrelling, all fueled by, you know, people like Luther with their tracts and their proclamations and their, what was it? How many articles was it? Was
97 it 49 or something?
He nailed some articles onto the door of a cathedral or something, and that caused a great stir. And there was a horrible German Civil War in the middle of the 16th century.
17th century.
No, 16th.
16th?
Yes.
Oh,
I think.
Okay.
I mean, it started then, in the 1500s, I think.
And we're not talking about the 30 Years' War, we're talking about something different.
The 30 Years' War, was that 16-something, sort of up until about 1650?
Yes, exactly, the Treaty of Westphalia.
Well, but I think even before then it was getting nasty. But yes, the 30 Years' War was one of the most destructive wars Europe's ever suffered, I think, wasn't it?
Yes.
In terms of loss of life.
Yeah.
I mean, sort of a third of Germans died or something spectacular. And Todd, I don't know how Todd proves it. I can't remember his arguments for that. But he asserts that, and I've never heard it contradicted, that Germany and Scandinavia were the first countries to be literate. However, in the early 19th century, in other words, after the 1780 takeoff had started happening in England, Germany was famous both for its literacy and for its economic backwardness. It didn't have a single factory, or it had hardly any.
Right.
And Karl Marx mocked Germany for being this ridiculously obscurantist and backward place.
Now, when was Marx doing his mocking? Because, well, Marx died in, what, 1882, something like that?
No, earlier than that. We're talking
he must have been doing
Communist Manifesto time.
Oh, right,
you know.
Okay.
Earlier than... In the 1850s, Germany was still... First of all, it wasn't politically united, but what happened was that in order to have an industrial takeoff, such as England achieved, you do need to have mass literacy in order for the work to get done, so that every worker is productive. I mean, literate workers...
Can we put some flesh on those bones? Can we think of some examples? I mean, I have this awful feeling that George Stevenson, for instance, was illiterate. I could be wrong on that.
I've heard different stories about that. I've heard that he read some books when he was young, so he couldn't have been. But I've also heard that he was illiterate. I remember seeing a play in Newcastle where he was learning how to read and write with his son, who was also a railway pioneer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not sure about that. But in general, in order for a modern economy to function, everybody in it has to be able to at least read a notice or a sign or an instruction or an order or something. Most people have to. And Germany in the early 19th century was a place where pretty much everybody could read and write a bit. And certainly well enough to keep notes in a notebook of what they've been doing and so on. But what the Germans did not have was the correct ideological attitude. In England, they did.
And the correct idea, I mean, I hope the answer is freedom and liberty, but...
Freedom's part of it. It's not the whole story, because I've already used this word improvement and invention. That didn't just mean improvements in weaving machines and steam engines, although it certainly did mean that. But it also meant improvement in government and in public works that were things like, in due course, they managed to get on top of the problem of sewage and urban cleanliness, building sewers and things like that. And that was all part of the way they thought, that this was an improvement, therefore it was a good thing. So it's not only, it was never entirely free market economics. But that was a big slice of it.
For instance, Prince Albert sponsoring the Great Exhibition is part of it.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And indeed, the aristocracy in general became persuaded of these opinions. Now, this is where Steve Davis's book, The Wealth Explosion, is worth mentioning. What he argues is that what made Europe different from the rest of the world, and therefore caused Europe to develop economically in a different way from the rest of the world, was that it was never politically united. Now, what that meant was that Europe in about 1700 and 1800, that sort of time, was in a state of constant national rivalry. And that meant that national elites could never neglect innovation and improvement, because they were constantly trying to innovate and improve in matters like gunnery and explosives and siege engines and things of that sort. So you had an elite which understood the arguments for improvement and had their own preoccupations, which meant that they could never simply stagnate the economy and remain in charge of it, which is exactly what happened in China. In China, in the 16th century, they were doing very well. They were hurtling forward under the Song dynasty, but then they threw the whole thing into reverse and actually stamped out shipbuilding technology. They literally destroyed it and prevented people from learning about it.
Do we know why?
Not fully. I don't think people are fully aware of the thinking, but that is definitely what happened. I mean, there were all sorts of reasons. I mean, one of them was that the weakness of China was blamed on these tradesmen, you know, who are far too interested in their own advantage and creature comforts and not enough in the safety of the empire and all that sort of thing. And there was a conservative reaction against what would have been the Chinese Industrial Revolution. And Davis's book has this story at the heart of it. And his argument is that Europe, crucially, couldn't do that because Europe wasn't a single political system.
Yes, yes.
And he makes much of the failure of the Spanish Armada, which was Philip II's attempt, essentially, to snuff out the Protestant revolutionaries of Holland and England, and basically take command of the heartland of Europe without challenge. But he didn't make it stick.
Right, he still had France and quite a lot of Germany, I believe. But
well, I mean, it was nowhere near successful. And there, I think, we come to another question that Steve Davis... You can imagine Davis writing another book about this, which was Europe developed economically because it was never politically united. But the next question immediately follows. Why was it never politically united? What he argues in his book is, well, it was frankly a close thing and it was a matter of chance. But I don't think you can write off European disunity as simply a consequence of just what happened to happen. I'd want to look at the ideological differences all over Europe that were already brought into being by mass literacy and starting
sorry,
to be
sorry,
felt.
I mean, I'm not quite following
well,
that. Well,
I think
might have something to do with why it was...
Lots of different power centres in Europe caused by the contrasting ideological attitudes of Europeans to each other, which meant that uniting them was virtually impossible. That would be my take on it.
I'm a bit surprised. I thought... Yeah, I don't know that much about medieval history, but I thought the ideologies were more or less the same because everyone was under the Catholic Church.
Well, they were until mass literacy struck, and then it was revealed that each region tended to have its own attitude. And crucially, and this is where Immanuel Todd comes into his own, depending on the different family systems of Europe, you get different results from these revolutions. The English Revolution of the 17th century, the German of the 16th century, the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution all had their distinct atmospheres because they were different sorts of countries with different sorts of assumptions about power, which they derived from their experience of family life. So, for example, the position, the role of the father in a family and how long he remains in charge, you know, and does he dominate the lives of his adult children or not, that sort of thing. It's very different in different parts of Europe. And what is the relationship between men and women, between siblings? Are there equal or unequal legal arrangements for inheritance? And so on. All of these things differ, crucially, in different parts of Europe. And when mass literacy spreads over Europe, which it did from Germany through northern France to England, Scotland, These differences were thrown into sharp relief rather than just homogenized. So, in other words, uniting Europe might have been a lot harder to do than Davies makes it seem. It wasn't just the failure of one Spanish fleet. it would have, if even if the Armada had been victorious, would Philip II have been able to subjugate England? It doesn't follow, I don't think. This is 1588, by the way. The Spanish Armada was, that was the big drama, and it was blown off course, and that, and it therefore failed to link up with the Philip's Continental Army and cross the Channel and subjugate the English.
I mean, of course, the Romans were able to. I mean, this is maybe going a bit too far. The Romans were able to subjugate at least Western Europe. Were really stopped by the German forests, which they just found just impassable. So
yes,
that was well, that.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the Todd, the Emmanuel Todd drama, which he presented in those two 1980s books, The Explanation of Ideology and the Causes of Progress, and that's about the interaction of mass literacy and family structure. Well, of course, the Romans were well before that time. I think Todd is at his most persuasive and illuminating when he writes about that historical event. But he,
which historical event?
Well, the revolutions provoked by mass literacy, succession of revolutions. I think he's fantastically illuminating on those subjects. However, I think, I mean, perhaps now is the time to say that Todd, I think, misses the Industrial Revolution as being one of the revolutions. You know, you've got the French, the Russian, Chinese, the German one before it. He doesn't see the Industrial Revolution as part of that, that hand of cards,
well,
as it were.
I must admit, on the face of it, I'm kind of with him, because the others are political revolutions.
Yes. Well, the point is this, that the English ideology contained many implications for politics. I mean, the assertion of bourgeois equality, you know, that we're as good as them when we're confronting the aristocracy, clearly has political connotations. You know, it means that it implies something rather like mass suffrage, which, of course, took a long time to happen. But central to the English ideological ferment of the 17th century was the right of individuals to function as free economic agents. And here, I think your point about freedom is very important. It's not just a statement about we're as good as them. It's a statement of, and they should damn well leave us alone and let us get on with our lives. And, of course, that has an economic dimension built into it. I mean, it's a statement about how the economy should be governed.
I'm getting a little bit confused here, because, I mean, there was a time when you had a feudal system, which seems to me to be the sort of epitome of not being able to do what you damn well please. But the feudal system collapsed. When did it collapse? I think probably by the time of Henry VII.
Well,
it's no longer functional.
Well, the crucial thing, I keep coming back to it, majority literacy, especially among young men, that is when you get the transformation, because that's when young men start lecturing their parents and anybody else they can shout at about how the world is and how it should be. And young men love to start fights, and they sort of exaggerate the differences between their own brilliant and wonderful selves and the benighted elders. But that's the revolutionary moment.
Revolutions cannot happen without mass literacy.
Well, these revolutions are all mixed up with mass literacy. I'm not going to say that you can't have revolutions without mass literacy, but it certainly helps. And it helps if it's mass literacy for the first time, because then you get a whole generation of people with a self-consciously distinct and different point of view to their predecessors.
But doesn't this kind of undermine this argument that about Sweden and Germany? Because,
well,
to my mind, the 30 Years' War and the English Civil Wars are very similar.
Yes. Well, they are, except that in Germany there was no economic argument. There was no argument for improvement. All the improvement was going to be religious.
Right. Right.
Whereas there are explicitly economic arguments put forward by Lilburn and by all the other people mentioned in McCloskey's writings. And by and large, you can say that the English revolutionary ideology was only a very partial success on the political front, in that the aristocracy retreated, but they certainly weren't executed in any large numbers, you know. And the Glorious Revolution was a sort of fudge which worked, but which kept aristocrats very much with a superior position in the political system. However, there was also the economic argument, and quite a lot of the aristocracy of England were persuaded by these things. I mean, think of all these aristocratic people.
What period are we? Are we talking about the period of the Glorious Revolution, or are we talking about 100 years later?
Early 18th century, mid 18th century, that sort of time.
Okay.
When people were building, I mean, the aristocracy were building canals on their own land.
The Duke of Northumberland's River, somewhere near
yep.
me.
Was it the Earl of Bridgewater? I can't remember, but there were. And also the aristocracy were quite heavily involved in agricultural innovation, which was a very important kind of innovation at that time, not least because so many people were involved in agriculture.
Farmer George. George III was known as a farmer, wasn't he?
So in other words, the English ideology, as I'm calling it, with its economic dimension, achieved a great deal of success among the elite and among lawyers and judges and people like that, who saw the point of that was being made about how if you have new gadgets, that'll improve the lot of mankind in the long run, which was different from the state of affairs in somewhere like Germany.
Ah, and the German aristocrats weren't worried about being conquered because they were so far behind.
Well, the content of the German Revolution was Protestantism, and there were plenty of Protestant aristocrats in Germany, weren't there? Protestant princes, but they didn't spend their time talking with each other about what a good idea it would be to improve the productivity of, I don't know, machines for sowing corn or reaping corn or smelting iron or something. That wasn't the way they were thinking at that time. That only came later. Now, the interesting thing is that the point made to me by Anton Haus, that if I was right about the importance of literacy, the Germans would have had their industrial revolution, is exactly the attitude of Todd himself. Todd sees, certainly in those two early books, he presents the Industrial Revolution as a bit of an oddity. It's that rather weird moment in history when the English, for reasons that frankly don't make much sense, raced ahead economically. However, sanity soon reasserted itself in the late 19th century when the Germans, with their superior literacy, reasserted themselves and have been ahead of the English ever since. So for Todd in the 1980s, the Industrial Revolution was a bit of an anomaly, a bit of an oddity. It was sort of an accident that the English happened to start it, but then the Germans took it in hand and reorganized it, and normality reasserted itself. Lineages of modernity.
I suppose the question is, are the Germans ahead as we speak?
Well, yes, that's a good question. But in terms of sheer volume and efficiency and those sorts of things, I think they are, aren't they?
My understanding is it's complicated, as they say. I mean, yes, the German industries we know about are very good and have been for 100 years. But I believe they were still, I mean, the average German was considerably poorer than the average Briton on the eve of the First World War.
Ah, yes.
So,
But the point is, the Germans had a kind of national debate in the late 19th century where they said, what are we going to do about these damn English? You know, they're making fools of us. And the conclusion they arrived at was a sort of variant of their traditional way of doing things, which was that they would study science in universities, and they invented the concept of academic freedom to ensure that the universities did their job and were able to have the arguments they needed to have about what was scientifically correct. In other words, academic freedom was originally a theory of freedom in academies, but not everywhere else.
Brian, do we know who the names of any of the people who participated in this debate?
No, I'm very weak on that.
Right, okay.
This is my first attempt to explicate all this, and I'm almost putting forward a thesis rather than illustrating it very well. And I think your questions will guide my future reading on these matters, and I'll probably come back to it and talk about particular episodes which I've studied, which I haven't studied now, but which I will have studied. I mean, the short answer is no, I can't really flesh it out with anecdotage the way I'd like to, and the way Anton Howes does in his writings.
Well, I can't really complain, because I'm rubbish at anecdotes as well, anecdotal evidence. But
you need grand theories to find out what you're going to read in the first place, to find out what episodes you regard as crucial and what episodes you regard as just random, so that you can read about the crucial events as you see it. Well, how do you decide whether something's crucial? It's the answer is your theories about what it all led to and where it was all going. So Steve Davis studies the details of the Spanish Armada operation because he thinks that was make or break for the unification of Europe. And the fact that it didn't unify Europe is what separated Europe from the rest of the world and made the Industrial Revolution possible. Because, you see, in the heart of Steve Davis's thinking is that Industrial Revolution happened because it was allowed to, and that it wasn't allowed to in lots of other places. That's what he says. That's the difference.
Yes.
But he doesn't credit mass literacy as a reason for it. He just thinks it was, these things were happening all over the world. You know, there were enlightened people arguing for science and technology and so on everywhere. If anything, in Davis's world, Europe, he points out that Europe was a bit of a backwater economically until it went racing ahead in the end of the 18th century.
Really?
Yes, that's what he says. Well, certainly, right up until very recently, i.e. about 1700, the economies of China and India were much more, the total amount of gross national product in those places was vast compared to Europe, and a lot of the so-called European voyages of discovery were not discovery in the sense of discovering benighted heathen savages. It was a case of discovering basically richer and superior civilization centered around the Indian Ocean.
I would point out that it was a case of Europeans finding them and not them finding Europeans.
Yeah, it was. It was, definitely. But it was a case, it was rather like a kind of bigger version of the way the peasantry descends on the city whenever it gets the chance, because there's a better life there. We don't think of that as the city conquered by the peasantry, although arguably that's sort of what happened. And we shouldn't think of the early stages of the European discovery, in inverted commas, of the rest of the world as being a conquest. It was only very late on in the story that it became a conquest, when the big difference is that the people who ruled the rest of the world had big artillery trains and presided over economically stagnant societies. The Europeans never stopped developing, and there came a moment when their guns were better than the guns of the, the Indians or the Chinese. And
yes,
Suddenly they started winning battles. But that was quite late on in the story. That was sort of 18th century that happened. I mean, the big battles in India, the Battle of, was it Plassey? Clive, I do know his name. It was a bit of a nasty moment for the hitherto rather relaxed Easterners when they realized that they could, that it only took a handful of these savages from abroad with their horrible guns to defeat them.
Yes, well, yes.
Must have been a...
Commodore Perry's black ships appearing in Tokyo Harbor.
Yes, yes. Well, that's roughly my story. I'm arguing that if you put Todd, Davies, McCloskey and Howes together, it all fits, which is not the story they tell of each other. I mean, it's basically Todd on one side and then the other three on the other.
Well, I was going to say, Todd seems to be the odd man out here, including in... You seem to have rejected him, mostly.
No, I haven't rejected him.
Okay.
How have I rejected him?
Well, I thought you felt his
What I've rejected is his interpretation of the English Revolution. His interpretation of all the other revolutions is correct. he gets the English Revolution wrong, and it doesn't fundamentally alter the splendor of
the English Revolution or the Industrial Revolution?
No, both. They're the same thing. That's the point. They're the same thing. And he doesn't see that. McCloskey does, you see, and Howes in a different way. But McCloskey sees how the political ferment of the 16th century and the subsequent economic case are all one and the same thing. And Todd doesn't see that, and therefore he's baffled by the English. However, if you come on to Lineages of Modernity, you come across Todd having... He knew he was confused by the English in the 80s. He didn't know what to make of the English Revolution. So he's spent a lot of time thinking about it since then. But his answer is still not ideological. He still says that the English pioneered the Industrial Revolution. Yes, they did, and there were reasons for this, but the reasons are just to do with the flexibility of the family system and the generally kind of free and easy approach of the English to life. He doesn't quite grasp that it was an ideological achievement. You see, and by the way, he's in common with everybody educated since then, practically. Why is that? It's because the English Revolution is an example of a group of starry-eyed idealists proclaiming that they knew what was best for mankind, saying what they thought ought to be done about it. And, you know, the idea that people behaving and thinking like that should not only be right, but right, even more right than they would have fantasized about, is deeply foreign to all our experience since then. I mean, ideologists and idiots both begin with the first two letters, and most people think it's no coincidence that people who think they know how to improve mankind are just a menace. You know, they're going to be executing people in no time at all, guillotining them and gulagging them, and to hell with them. And the idea that ideologists could be triumphantly right is something that's frankly been forgotten, because why would you believe that?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons
in the modern world,
one of the reasons is these huge time lags between what Lil Bill Byrne was saying in the 1640s and, you know, the takeoff 140 years later. Is there? I mean, you talked about the attitudes of the aristocrats in the early 18th century, which is a nice link to have. I mean, are we confident there is a clear continuation from Lilburn, which carries on to 1780s without
too many
breaks.
I think McCloskey makes that case very well.
Right.
I don't think McCloskey proves that all these writings had consequences, but I think Howes does prove that. I can't be certain of what McCloskey says because I haven't read it all, but I do know she assembles lots and lots of opinions by lots of different authors and propagandists.
Can we think of any consequences that arose in that period?
Well, I would recommend...
Let's say, for example, why does the Industrial Revolution happen in 1780 and not, say, 1680?
Well, I've just been reading one of Anton Howes's essays, the second most recent, and it's called The Paradox of Progress, I think. And he points out that it could well be that graph that you and I are both so fond of, the one with the great big kink in it, is perhaps rather misleading, because what it actually tracks is energy and the consumption of energy and the application of energy, which in 1780 went leaping forwards because they suddenly started using coal to power the Industrial Revolution. But in fact, it could well be, Howes argues, that there really was a kind of graph of improvement in everyday life, which more resembled what the improvers thought they were doing. There was, for example, quite a lot of there was a quite big increase in the discretionary income of people before 1780. The ability of the aristocracy to spend.
I'm going to just butt in and do my pseudo-Chenoy business. Pseudo-Chenoy was a big mucker with Friedrich von Hayek, and she did write, well, in her PhD, she writes that actually there was a huge improvement before the English Civil War
Yes.
In living standards, in things like, you know, furniture and clothes and
cutlery
and all this
yes,
sort of stuff.
Glass. Yes, this is what Howes writes about as well. Yes. And I think that makes sense. I think that kink may be slightly misleading in that it gross national product is a rather slippery concept. I mean, to give you an example, people often talk about how inventiveness has ground to a halt since 1980, to which my answer is, what planet have you been living on? You know.
And how are they measuring inventiveness then?
Exactly. And if you're measuring inventiveness by the amount of money spent on inventions, then you miss the point entirely, because the whole point of the inventions we've had in the period between 1980 and now is that the cost of everything has come crashing downwards. So you can now buy what amounts to a supercomputer and carry it about in your pocket and pay whatever it is a month, you know.
But it's also that those supercomputers do a lot more.
Yes, of course.
Than they did.
And they enable us to do things we'd never done before, like have blog postings about our recorded conversations. And, you know, this evening somebody could be listening to this. But none of that shows up in the gross national product numbers, as far as I can tell.
I suppose we could also talk about, today I have been buying a pair of shoes. Now, 20 years ago, you have to go to a shoe shop. You have to make a journey. There's a limited selection. You hope for the best.
Mm.
Nowadays, well, you do it all online.
The world has turned into one enormous department store, hasn't it?
Yes.
And that's a definite improvement in lots of ways. I mean, books. These books that I've been piling up. I got the two Todd books in remainder shops, but the others I was able to buy online. And I might have had great difficulty getting them if it hadn't been for that. I don't think I'd have been able to get the Todd Lineages of Modernity or the Wealth Explosion.
Although, as I understand it, not everything he's ever written has been translated into English.
That's true.
So maybe the stuff in there which would solve all our questions about him.
But the Lineages of Modernity is a very interesting book. I mean, he remains maddeningly casual when he comes to discussing the 1780 moment and the fact that it was English. But the general thesis is that, the title of the book, let me just dig it out from the pile. The title of the book is Lineages of Modernity, and the subtitle is A History of Humanity from the Stone Age to Homo Americanus. And the thesis is, and like me, Todd is very strong on theses, and you wonder about the proofs exactly, because he writes about so many different things on such a grand scale. I mean, the sweep is unbelievable, but you can't help suspecting that details get neglected. But his basic idea is that Homo Americanus is more like Stone Age man than all these complicated family systems in Asia and places like that. And that, you see, in those first two books, the family system of each place was a given, and it was unchanging. You couldn't alter it in the space of 50 years. However, you can alter it over a longer period. And his argument is that these family systems came into existence in the period of, well, history, you know. And they are artificial human creations. And they have the effect of slowing down progress. In other words, he attributes the progress of the inventiveness of Anglo-American culture to its general sort of free and easy attitude to life. But not.
And the Stone Age people had a sort of free and easy attitude towards life.
Okay. Yes, that's what he asserts. Again, a very good grand theory, a very impressive and interesting one. But no doubt, all the experts whose toes have been trodden on will have things to say about this if they can't ignore it. I mean, I think Todd's problem is he writes about so many things that he offends almost everybody,
as opposed to illuminating them.
Well, you know what specialists are like. If you contradict them with a suggestion that achieves popular success but doesn't dig in academia so strongly, they get very angry and dismiss it as absolute rubbish. I mean, they behave rather like Anton Howes behaved towards it, you know.
Right, okay.
I mean, Todd still doesn't seem to have much clout in Anglo-Saxon academia. There are a few people have now started reading him. Interestingly, they're often people who've written about the Trump matter, because Todd has written about that. And there's a clutch of writers. David Goodhart is one in particular, who've written about the phenomenon of the anywheres versus the somewheres. I think we've mentioned this in previous conversations.
I'm quite sure we did, yes.
Well, Todd throws a lot of light on that and has things to say about it, and those writers have therefore started paying attention to what Todd has said. But they still don't respond to the heart of what Todd says, which I think is the story of all those revolutions. Everybody seems to, maybe I'm just the same as everybody else. I cherry pick from Todd what I want to cherry pick because I think it's true and fascinating. And I tend to sort of downplay the rest. And for me, it's his analysis of the literacy provoked revolutions that is the heart of his achievement and makes me regard him as a great historian. But I find his ruminations on things like Donald Trump and for that matter, earlier, the Nazis and so on, whom he does regard as a bit similar, as less overwhelmingly interesting, put it that way. And maybe...
Maybe he's a... I mean, he's an academic, isn't he, Todd?
Oh, yes. I mean, he's a French academic, not in the university. I don't know how they organise their intellectual life over there, but he's in some sort of Institute of Demographics or something based in Paris and has been for a long time. And he's also a public commentator on a fairly ferocious scale. He's very scathing about the European Union.
For reasons I presume that we've already discussed.
Well, because of the differences between different Europeans and notably the English, you know. I don't think Brexit was grist to his mill, you see. You know, those English, they're different. They're not like us. Don't kid yourself that they can be Europeanized. It's not going to work. That's his attitude. And likewise, the French and the Germans are very different from each other. And so that's in the long run isn't going to work. And in general, he says, people are different from each other the world over. So globalization is not going to homogenize us all. I think that's a bit of a straw man. I think the original proponents of globalization didn't argue that everyone was going to become the same, but that everyone was going to trade with each other on a much increased scale and get to know each other and get to like each other more, which, of course, hasn't quite happened. But Todd's point is a good one, that just because everybody's driving around in cars and building skyscrapers doesn't mean that they all have the same political attitude.
No.
Stunned silence. What do you make of all this, Patrick? I mean, I've been doing most of the talking, but
I simply don't know is the answer to that.
I take your point about my failure to flesh it out with lots of detail, to illustrative detail. I plead guilty
to
that.
I was going to say that. I mean, because I'm so steeped in this idea that it was all a glorious accident that I find.
Yeah, you see, I think Adam Smith is to blame for this.
Who was to blame?
He, Adam Smith.
Right.
People. Well, the modern reaction to Adam Smith, that the idea that people improve the world without even trying to, just following their own selfish interests. I think that idea has distorted our understanding of...
Well,
of
Brian, I seem to remember a few years ago you wanted to write some fictions about a man who was trying to destroy the world, and every time he did, he actually made it better.
Yes,
that's
well,
how that capitalism
was because
works.
His theory was wrong. He was a Marxist who yes, well, it's a good story, put it that way. it's called The Lion's Share, and I recommend it strongly. I reread it the other day. It's quite good. Of course, you still get plenty of people having consequences they didn't intend. But I'm afraid you can't write off the English Revolution and the people who promoted it as an example of that. I mean, all the other revolutions were full of idiots who thought they were going to do one thing and who accomplished often the exact opposite. I mean, in France, it wasn't too bad.
Oddly enough, only today I was reading one of these email circulars by people we would normally agree with, some libertarian financial people in America, who were condemning Oliver Cromwell and praising, to some extent, Charles I. So it's not...
Mm-hmm. Well, Cromwell was by no means a... He wasn't a typical revolutionary. He was much more of a... Well, he believed in a strong state, and you know, I don't see Cromwell as a central figure in all this. I see him as more like a Napoleonic figure who emerged to sort out the mess caused by the Civil War. But he didn't make it stick, did he?
I think he did.
Ah,
I would argue, but then that's my big theory of history is that he was a central figure in transforming Britain from a monarchy to a republic.
Yeah. And the monarchy.
Yeah, it didn't all stick when he died, but so much of it did. I mean, effectively, yes. I think we're more of a republic than we are a monarchy, let's put it like that.
Yes, yes, that's true. Well, it all right, let me put it this way. Cromwell was a central figure in the political resolution of the English Revolution. But he wasn't a central figure in the what I'm calling the economic aspect of it all.
Right.
He didn't have much to say about that, I don't think. Or maybe I'm wrong about that, but I don't think he did.
I have no idea. I have no idea if he changed anything much in the 1650s.
Mm.
Might have done. I don't know.
He might have made some changes to the manner in which guns were acquired by his army. I can believe he did that. But not. I think this whole business of guns is fascinating, as a sort of central technology. Basically, the strength of metals under stress. It begins with bells. It continues with cannons, and then gradually smaller firearms. And of course, then it continues with steam engines, where you have the same problem of a metal container with fantastically strong forces operating inside it.
Yes.
And you'd better get your metalwork right, put it that way.
Yeah.
So there's and that's, you know, people sneer at the Chinese for having gunpowder but only making fireworks out of it. Well, that's the reason. The Chinese were very good at gunpowder, but they weren't nearly so good at the metalworking side. So if
which
they
also
had,
suggests they may not have been their lead may not have been as great as we.
No,
we
that, oh, the lead was strictly in terms of the wealth, the total amount of wealth that was swimming around in these countries, and in that sense, India and China were the centre of the world. I mean, they had by far the biggest populations, for example, didn't they?
And still do.
Yes, and so you know, if you could trade with the Far East. You were a European. You were quids in.
Yeah, which was the whole point of Columbus, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, that's he was trying to get to the Indies and found himself in the West Indies by mistake. Yes, it turned out there was a great big continent in between, you know, the Atlantic and China.
Yes, yes. Now, what were we doing? Were we trying to summarize in some way? Was that what
well,
you were trying to do,
I invited you to comment, and then of course
yes,
I interrupted
yes.
you, which is my standard method. Forgive me.
Yeah, and I we've gone to talk about Adam Smith, didn't we, at one point?
Well, my central claim is we've got here some ideologists who succeeded, and we're not used to that, and we can't even see. So unused are we to that we can't even see it when it happens. Even on a colossal world-shaping scale, which it did.
I mean, I suppose
interesting story of forgetting.
I mean, in a sense, I'd like that to be true because you know we're sort of ideologists. We believe in ideas.
Yeah, we certainly are ideologists. Yes.
And, but I'd be far happy if I saw more sort of cause and effect.
Yes.
Well,
the reason that it seems to me there are two ways you prove something. Not just one. One is you prove it with facts and illustrations and anecdotes, but the other is, and it's perhaps rather dangerous, but it makes sense. It all fits together as a big picture story. And that's the kind of reasoning I'm using. And I'm aware that that's somewhat dodgy.
Right.
I mean, put it this way. One of the reasons I'm an atheist is that I don't think there's any evidence for the existence of God. But the other big reason why I'm an atheist is that I don't think the idea of God makes any sense.
Right. I could argue. I'll ask you about that.
Well, we can argue. Obviously, anybody could argue. But my point is that it's not just evidence. And the way I put this once in an argument with a friend of mine recently was when they said, is there any evidence that would persuade you of the existence of God? And I said, yes, if there was, I'd change my mind. But then I realized, no, I wouldn't. I can imagine no evidence that would change my mind because the idea of God makes no sense. Therefore, whatever happens, God can't be the explanation because God is gibberish. That was my argument. I'm not trying to persuade you or anyone of the truth of it. I'm just illustrating that arguing is not just a question of facts. It's a question of whether the whole picture you're offering makes sense as a coherent, self-consistent world. And I think the sort of resolution I've tried to sketch in this monologue, stroke, conversation, makes sense. And especially I think that about Immanuel Todd's writings. I think they make sense. That's why I think they're true. It's not just that I think he amasses evidence, which I find persuasive. It's that it fits with my understanding of how things work.
It sounds as if you've gone beyond Todd in the sense that you think Todd applies to things that Todd doesn't think it applies to.
Yeah, I think Todd himself could make more sense of the English Revolution than he actually does.
Yeah.
So he's got something to learn from McCloskey and Howes, but they have something to learn from him.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Davis has something to learn because he's not only writing about why the wealth explosion happened, he's also writing about what modernity is. And I think it's a very interesting book, his one. It's very strange because it's one book and it could easily have been three, whereas McCloskey's writings are three books and could easily have been one and should have been. If she wanted to make it easy for her readers to work out what the hell she was saying, she would have written one clear book instead of three vast volumes of ranting. I think she based her books on Karl Marx's Das Kapital, who Karl Marx faced the problem of how am I going to persuade people to believe something I haven't proved, which was the immiseration thesis. And his answer was, well, pile on the words to the point where they can't possibly read all of it. And that way they won't oppose it. And the only people who do read it will be the true believers. I think McCloskey has a similar attitude towards how to present her opinions. The only difference being, quite an important one, that she's right. But she doesn't prove she's right. That's my suspicion about her. I think I could probably usefully read her more thoroughly to get the detail that you've been talking about.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting.
Maybe the result of this conversation has been to, whereas my attitude to those books was I'm not going to spend the rest of my life reading them, maybe I am going to spend the rest of my life reading them now. Maybe that's what it makes me want to do. But the idea that the Industrial Revolution was deliberately achieved by ideologists is very, very interesting and goes against most of the thinking of, as I say, modern educated people.
Yes, it's fascinating, I suppose.
I hope it is.
Yeah.
And to anyone who thinks it's been a bit incoherent, I agree. This is my first stab at a public statement of all these things. So I'm sure we'll return to it at some point, just as we keep returning to the First World War, which is another of those world-shaping events. Seems to have poisoned everything that followed, you know. That, whereas the 1780 liftoff made everything wonderful that followed. I mean, you can exaggerate that, but not much, frankly. I mean, the spectacular improvement in human creature comfort is just wonderful and extraordinary.
Yes. Isn't it just? And some people are in it.
Yes, sense. I know. I was thinking that. There's another whole argument about that, isn't there? Well, of course, that was part of what McCloskey was trying to bury with just a great pile of argument to the effect no, it was really good what happened. Don't you dare turn the clock back and try and switch it off. It would be terrible. Most of us would have to be killed. I mean, most of us would just die, wouldn't we?
Yes, in a word. With some people, they regard that as a benefit. So.
Well, yes, I know.
There you go. Brian, I don't have any more thoughts or questions. Do you?
I think I've said what I've said as best I could. I hope it made sense. No, I don't have anything more to say, I don't think.
Okay, well, we'll end it there then.